Hello, welcome to the 12 Heeds. We'd like to welcome Douglas Chapman, the MP for Dunfermline, since the night in 2015 when Scotland won all but three Westminster seats. Douglas has the dubious honour of being the MP that represents the area where seven nuclear submarines have been left to rot in the Forth. Welcome to the 12 Heeds, Douglas.
Thanks very much. Yeah, pleasure
to be here. Douglas.
Hello there.
What do you like?
I'll kick this off because I know it's going to be a topic we've kind of all agreed on, which is the future of Rosyth. That's where your MP's office is, Douglas.
That's right, yeah. I think the future of Rosyth, and I think this has got to be sort of taken in the round because we're obviously going through fairly dire economic circumstances at the moment for everyone. But there's certainly great potential at Rosyth for the future, and that's despite what our opponents might say, that's always been the position of the SNP, both locally and I think nationally. You know, we can see the benefits of having a deep water port that's not affected by the tide or anything like that. And that gives us a lot of access for shipping, but also as we look towards what's going to happen with Brexit, then I'm absolutely convinced that it's ludicrous that a country the size of Scotland and what has been our exporting potential is ignored by the fact that we can't have a direct link into the heart of Europe, Rosyth to Zeebrugge or Rosyth to one of the other northern European ports, and perhaps use Rosyth as a bit of a hub for future services as well. You know, one of the things that people keep writing to me about is the prospect that, why are we just looking to northern Europe, why not, or to Zeebrugge? Why are you not looking at Scandinavian countries as well? But I think we need to start on a basis that's going to be economically viable and then take things from there. And I think once you have one route into the site, then I think it'd be easier to establish a second one to a different port and a different part of Europe, for example, Scandinavia.
Dave did a post previewing the fact that we're going to have this discussion, Douglas. A very interesting thing arose between Dave and a lady called Lara Mulholland, which was related to the fastest catamaran ship in the world, which currently goes between two major cities in South America. Mm-hmm. But what interested me was that ship, fastest one in the world, catamaran, was actually built in Tasmania. Now, we've got a heritage in shipbuilding. Tasmania's population is only 500,000 people. Mm-hmm. So everything that you're talking about, and what came out of that was Lara then did a timescale on it about whether she got the train down to London or to Felixstowe, whether she got a plane and waited at the airport to get on the plane. All the calculations she did, it would be easier, and I come from North Ayrshire, as you know, it would be easier for me to drive through to Rosyth, get on the ferry, and I'd arrive in Zeebrugge faster than any other alternative I had.
Yeah. Well, I think these are all the things that need to be sorted out. Certainly, we've had a ferry service before, and it didn't meet everyone's needs because the ship that was being used was a bit slower than the one that you've suggested. But the very fact that people can get on a ship in central Scotland, basically, it's easy to access through the motorway network and so on, bring their car, their caravan, their motorbike, their motorhome, get right onto a ferry, and they wake up the following morning refreshed and ready to continue their journey into wherever their destination might be, whether that's France or Germany or maybe Switzerland or wherever, Italy. It just gives them that other opportunity. I think it works the other way around as well, obviously. because there's a whole market of bikers and people who've got caravans and motorhomes and so on who want to travel around Scotland. But, you know, the thought of getting a ferry into Dover and then having to drive another 500 miles to even start your holiday before you begin really doesn't make that much sense. And I think there's really good opportunities, especially at a time where the COVID crisis has knocked a huge hole in our tourism industry. I think we should be looking at every possible angle to try and encourage people back to Scotland when it's safe to do so. And, you know, having a ferry service directly into, from our point of view, from Rosyth into the heart of Europe or vice versa, you know, I think it works for everyone concerned, and for me it's a win-win.
Is there any background preparation going on for that to take it forward?
Well, we were very close to identifying an operator in around about October, November time last year. Unfortunately, we just couldn't get the financial package they couldn't get the financial package together at that time. We had quite a fair number of discussions with Transport Scotland and you know, Scottish government ministers about levels of support. And while there are government grants available or would be available for that kind of service, mainly to enhance the port infrastructure, you know, we just couldn't put that package together at that time. But, you know, since then, I've had an old chestnut that keeps coming back. there's a chap who's highly experienced in the industry, who is very keen to see the service established. He's working just now in Ireland, and he says every time, and you know, to set up ferry services basically between the Republic of Ireland and Europe. And he said every time we get a win in Ireland for the ferry service, I keep thinking about Scotland could be doing this, Scotland should be doing this. Yeah. So he's becoming increasingly frustrated that he's working hard to set up the equivalent ferry services for the Republic of Ireland into Europe. And as I say, he cannot see for the life of him why, you know, we can't do a similar exercise here in Scotland. So I think it's a matter of actually trying to find the right kind of operator who had a real interest in running the service and a long-term interest in running the service. And that level of sustainability needs to be there right from the start. There's no point in trying to run things for a couple of years, then, you know, it all falls apart as it did in the past. And part of the reason it did fall apart was not because there wasn't enough traffic or there wasn't enough freight on the service, but, you know, the last operators, I think, were DFDS and Norfolk Line, who have got East Coast ports, either Newcastle or Hull or places like that, and all they wanted was all the information that, and in my opinion, all they wanted was the market information and build up contacts with people who would want to use their service. And as soon as Rosyth had served its purpose, then it was quickly dispatched off to the side, and everybody who was using the Rosyth service was said, "No, you can still go through Newcastle, you can still use our services through Hull and the South Coast ports." So really, we were sold a duck in that one, or sold a pup rather. And you know, I think there's great opportunities that still exist, and if a small country like the Republic of Ireland can have ferries running back and forward all day into the heart of Europe, then I have absolutely no idea why Scotland can't do the same.
I pointed out last week, Douglas, once we knew you were coming on, that Scotland has a maritime border of 6,000 miles, and the only hard border that we're actually, basically on the 31st of December, it's going to become a hard border with the whole Europe. And the only part of the border that's not going to be a hard border is like the 90 miles between Scotland, but everyone else is going to get shut off. And we turned it the other way and thought, well, okay, everybody keeps going on about the hard border between Scotland and England, which technically the Tories said wouldn't have been necessary with Ireland, so don't spoil me here, but if they did, and it opened up that massive coastline after independence, obviously, we would, rather than actually having the ship freight through across the border into England and then across another border into Europe, that it would be worth actually running freight out of a place like Rosyth, and sort of, I'm not exactly making it like Zeebrugge or Rotterdam, but it would be capable of being a really large freight port.
Yep, I agree. And, you know, a couple of things come to mind just when you're asking your question. We had a Zoom call, a wee bit like this one last week with the British-Irish Chambers of Commerce. And, you know, they're working really hard to maintain links with the UK beyond Brexit. And obviously, they've already got a strong foothold in Europe. So again, just coming back to the Irish example, you know, if they can manage that border with Northern Ireland and Scotland and the rest of the UK, if we decide to remain part of the UK, then, you know, good on them. And, you know, we should be looking to these international examples to say, you know, nothing is impossible in this situation. If people want to trade from A to B, then you find the best way of doing that. And here we are, you know, I think I read a quote a few weeks ago that almost every country in the world was trying to get to a position where there were fewer examples of having borders, you know, well, in terms of, you know, putting a cost on transferring goods across a border. You know, every other country was trying to cut down on all that paperwork and the tariffs and all the rest of it, and the UK is the only one that's going in exactly the opposite direction. They want to set up tariffs and, you know, with every other country, and, you know, it just means it makes a mockery of trying to actually build the economy at this time where it's under so much pressure. We should be making things easier for people to trade rather than making things much more difficult. Just one more example that we had. There was a time, probably, I can't remember if it was before the last election, before the election before that, because they just keep coming for Westminster MPs, like number 47 bus, you know, it seems to be one after another. However, we had a meeting when I was part of the European Scrutiny Committee. We met with Mr. Barnier in Brussels. It must be about 18 months ago now, at least. And, you know, part of that discussion was how on earth do countries that are just outside the EU, such as Norway, and their near neighbours Sweden, who are in the EU, how do they actually manage to trade and have a frictionless border as possible? And, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And I think the Norwegians and the Swedes have actually found not only the will, but they've found a way to allow them to trade on a daily basis without much difficulty. You know, I think if we were setting up our independent Scotland border with the non-EU part of the UK, which would be England, basically, you know, we would find ways to actually make that trade work, and they would find ways to make that trade work, because, you know, on both sides of the border, we all want to exchange our goods, sell our goods to each other, and for anybody to come along and say it can't be done, it wouldn't work, you know, what a disaster it would be. Yeah. Then we need that level of positivity to say, Why wouldn't you want it to work? You know, it just doesn't make sense for anybody. You've got to think about what's the win-win out of this situation, not how, you know, what the barriers and negativities would be around trading with your nearest neighbour.
I think it's the people that basically from the same place as you who are down the borders who desperately want to stick a spoke in it. The people who don't believe a border exists until you talk about shutting it down.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
What's your view, Douglas? I was going to ask you your view on Brexit being a no deal by maybe end of July.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've long held the view that that was the Tories' preferred outcome in any case. I think that, you know, they've had to go through lots of ups and downs along what has been a very, very bumpy road in terms of the negotiations. But my gut instinct has been that the majority of Tories, and especially the Tories that have been elected since last December, they've got rid of a lot of the sort of one nation, reasonably minded Tories, if you like, and replaced them with a lot of people who are out and out Brexiteers. So my sense is that that would be something that would go down very well with members of the Conservative group at Westminster if it was a no deal, but absolutely horrendous from a social point of view, absolutely horrendous from an economic point of view for the rest of the country. And obviously we've been shunned at every possible point in terms of, you know, plans being put on the table by the Scottish Government, ideas being put forward, suggestions being made, and we all know that these have just been totally rebuffed. Because I don't think the Conservative Party, Conservative Government in Westminster, really wants a deal at all. I think they'd be quite happy just to walk away and say, we're out of Europe, we've delivered Brexit, we didn't have to pay them a penny, and we're now an independent country, which the UK was, an independent entity, which the UK was before anyway. But that's the way they see things, and they see things completely differently from the way we would look at the relationship with Europe.
So given the difficulties of COVID on the economy and then adding a no-deal Brexit, is there a possibility that soft no's, and I'm thinking independence when I say the soft no's, will begin to realise it wasn't a clever idea?
Well, I don't know about you, but I think the people who are already coming to speak to me, quite a lot of them, for various reasons, are now realising that maybe they made a mistake in 2014, and maybe our campaign could have been better. But we're up against that. When you're up against the British state, it's actually quite difficult to make these arguments. But I think people are changing. There's a lot of people who have come to me recently, from family members through to friends that I know who voted no in 2014, who are now saying, if I'd known what the world would be like in 2020, then I would have voted for independence in 2014. As you say, out of Europe, in this COVID crisis where it doesn't look as if there's any strategic thought out way of getting through this from the UK government, the some of the worst death rates in the world, and it just seems to be so badly handled. And what has come out from the SNP's point of view, which is good, I think, is that at least, I'm sure Nicola Sturgeon would be the first person to admit that some mistakes have been made along the way, but I think the way she's handled the messaging through this period has been exemplary. I think it's been fantastic. And just the way that she has given clear, concise, and advice to the general public and the Scottish public, and at the same time as being coming across as being really compassionate, I think that has gone down well with a lot of people who actually didn't even like Nicola before. But the message I'm getting is, we actually like the way she's handled this, and while we can't watch the lineup of ministers that are on a daily basis on our TVs from London, people are quite happy to watch and listen to Nicola, which I think is great for, just winning people's confidence a wee bit and making sure that some of the soft no's, as you talk about, maybe are changing their tune.
The comparison between what has happened in Scotland and what is happening in terms of handling things from Westminster, the comparison is absolutely stark.
Yeah, night and day.
Just in terms of things like, we'll have a different app. Sorry, yes, we haven't got an app that will work. I mean, that is a senior government minister making promises that will never be fulfilled.
I think the sad thing in all of that is we've probably seen too many people die prematurely through this crisis.
Absolutely.
I think at the end of the day, it's their families and people who have been close to them have really taken that on had to take it on the chin. And I think if we had been an independent country, I think we'd be probably following more of a New Zealand model. And I've been in quite close contact with some friends in the Faroes and Iceland during the last 5 or 6 weeks. And again, the way that they've handled things has been wholly different from that of the UK. And I think, unfortunately, Scotland and a lot of the things that we've had to do have been linked in too closely to the UK approach. And I think that's caused a lot of deaths and a lot of heartbreak for a lot of people.
Dave.
Hi. A wee question is on another subject here, Douglas. 2 years ago in a week, if you can pass your mind back that far, to another world. You just walked out of Westminster for a day, and Scottish sovereignty was back in their own hands, and everybody in this country went, please don't go back and come back up the road. How did it feel to walk back in again?
I'm going back
into Westminster the day after you had all walked out.
The day after the in December, you mean, or just the?
No, the 2 years ago when you walked, when Ian Whiteford got kicked out. And
oh right. Yeah, right. Okay.
Was returned for 24 hours.
I know. I think there've been a few incidents, I think walking out was, we didn't know it was going to happen, I'll be honest with you. I mean, from the majority of people in the group, there might be one or two folk who had decided if X happens, then we'll make a swift exit. But the majority of the group didn't know that Ian was just going to go and leave the chamber. So, and we couldn't leave the poor guy to leave on his own. So we just trooped out after them. But it's these kind of things that have a pivotal impact for that split second. I think in the greater scheme of things, we need to really think very seriously about the strategy that will take us on to independence from where we are just now. As far as I can see, there's a heck of an amount of work that needs to be done around that, and hopefully we can start to step up to the plate. I was quite interested with the fact that Mike Russell said yesterday, I believe, that we should be putting the independence referendum back on the table again. Because from my perspective, and speaking on behalf of my constituents, I would say we don't want Westminster in its current format to reset the dials for the economy or for our society. And some of the dials, what's been clear, some of the dials need to be reset. We need to reset some of these things and have a different set of values than we had before the COVID crisis. So I would say that we need to get our ducks in a row and make sure that we're in a position to ask the people of Scotland again if they want independence. And if I believe that the majority would be coming to the conclusion that that is the best option for our European medium-sized country. And the reason I say that is there's lots of other countries who are European members, members of the EU, for example, who are tiny in comparison with Scotland. And to suggest that Scotland is uniquely going to be the one country that will fail being an independent country is just so ludicrous that we really need to think about how we present that argument and make sure that our strategy is absolutely spot on, so we can take the majority of the country with us the next time instead of losing out by a slender majority in 2014.
Are you aware of Martin Keating's legal case that's coming up in 6 weeks' time?
Yes, I, yeah.
One of your constituents, I believe.
Yes, Martin's been sort of pushing that one for a while, so I'll be interested to see how that one comes out as well. Yeah, I think there's a renewed vigour, I think, as well, amongst people. I think they really want to see something happen. I think you can tell by the number of people for different kinds of campaigns and different reasons, the number of people who are on the street at the moment and want to make their voices heard. Yeah. The Black Lives Matter issue came completely out of the ether. Nobody knew that was going to become such a huge issue. But I think it has just been apart from the racist issue, I think it's been a safety valve for people to express some of the long-held views about the kind of society they live in and just how unfair society is for a lot of our citizens, and not just our black citizens, but across the board. And when we see landowners in Scotland and owning vast tracts of land and not really putting it to the best use possible. We have a fantastic country here, and we need to make every square inch of it count and make sure that every single person has got a real contribution to make to the country. And I'm sure if the opportunities were laid in front of them, I'm sure a lot of people would jump at the chance.
Douglas, we haven't met before, but part of my background was finance. And one of the things that I noticed, and it's another issue that's come up, Brexit is one. I think I'm never sure this is correct, but I think a lot of people saw in 2014 that pensioners were scared over their pension. But recently, in the course of the last week, the Office for Budget Responsibility has analysed what they think will be the effect on the triple lock on pensions.
Yes.
And the OBR have suggested that next year wage increases might be in the order of 3%, but the year after 2022, it might be in the order of 19%, which would mean the triple lock. It's not inflation, it's low, but in terms of wage content, it might mean the triple lock might go up and a state pension would increase by perhaps 22% over those years. Next step, Mr. Sunak comes out and said, I may have to revisit this, despite the fact it was in our Conservative manifesto November last year. That type of thing is the type of thing that I think a lot of the Yes movement, I'll include I'm not a political party member, Douglas. I've got a great belief in the Yes movement for its great diversity, but we pick issues, and you're quite correct. There's a whole load of issues that came out in 2014 where we didn't plan enough. We didn't see them coming well enough. We weren't strategic enough. But I think there's messages. Pensions is one of them. Brexit is another one. I could go on. But from your visit, whether personally or Zoom meeting with Parliament, that's likely to happen, isn't it? There's going to be a rescind on the triple lock.
Well, I think so. I think that was the initial reaction from the Chancellor was to say that the triple lock is not set in stone yet. As you say, it was in the Conservative Party manifesto. I'm not sure if it's true or not, but I think I read something on social media that Boris Johnson said that we will stick to everything that was in the Conservative manifesto until we change it. So obviously everything is up for grabs, I think. And what we've seen over recent weeks, not just for older people, but also for younger people as well, a huge embarrassment for the government in terms of free school meals over the yeah. summer months, and the very fact that it had to come from an England goal scorer, Manchester United player, it just speaks volumes, I think, for the way in which this government wants to run the country. And I think we're at the very start of a very slippery slope indeed. But I think going back to what you're saying about independence, I think winning the sort of more people who are getting on a wee bit, like myself. You know, I think winning them over is going to be absolutely crucial as well. And I think once the triple lock goes, and I'm sure, as I'm sure it will, I think people will begin to realise that, you know, when they look across Europe, they can see people being paid pensions that are much more generous than anything that is provided by the broad shoulders of the UK. And we can use that term. And, you know, I think people will begin to waken up. Just as I think in 2014, I think a lot of young people woke up to the politics and, you know, the position of Scotland. And I think maybe this time round, I think a lot of older people will begin to realise that the union that they used to hold so dear is not really worth the not worth a candle.
Yeah, Dave.
Hi, I've got a wee thing here. it's going back to your public, but public procurement during this pandemic. It was one of the powers that was grabbed, if you like, with the power grab. And I noticed you'd spoken it a couple of years ago, or maybe it was 2019. When you'd said that they were going to throw the baby out with the Brexit bathwater. And I wondered if now that they've basically grabbed procurement, if you think that's actually helped to cause all the trouble with the PPE requirements that Scotland's had.
Well, yeah, okay, it could be. I mean, I think there's just on the procurement side, I was maybe not to answer your question directly, but I noticed that the Commonweal had a really interesting paper out just on how to get through the COVID crisis, and I think they're working on a wider economic prospectus for Scotland as being an independent country. But I think one of the good things that they came out with, and it's an area that I've got quite a lot of interest in, is things like food production and how, you know, through if we set up a system where we could start we do already, we grow quite a lot of our own food as it is, but if all the public procurement was done, like for hospitals, for school meals, for even for government offices and things like that, if they were part of procurement was that they had to buy from Scottish suppliers, then you know that we could actually give our farming industry a real shot in the arm, a real boost, and our fishermen and all the food producers we do have. So I think that's a really good idea, and it's sort of the kind of thinking that we need to explore more widely as we get towards independence. Because I think these are all the ideas that we need to try and find the real solution to this, so that if we are spending the public pound or whatever the new currency is going to be called, if we're spending that on behalf of the Scottish people, then it should be also trying to benefit our food production services and our farmers and growers across the country. And it would be great if actually, I mean, a lot of people tell me that Scotland's got the best larder in the world, but it'd be actually good if people in Scotland actually used the best larder in the world as well. You know, I don't think we probably eat enough seafood or fish or vegetables or fruits or all the great stuff that we grow here in Scotland and export abroad. It'd be great if, in terms of our own health, that we decide to eat maybe a bit more broccoli and kale, and I'm not taking it purely from a vegetarian point of view. I'm not a vegetarian, but I'm sure Scottish beef and lamb as well would fit into that mix. But we tend to, I think, look to export markets where we really should be using a lot of that produce here in Scotland.
I think Mr. Green decided that.
I think I diverted around your question there, but you got an answer.
It's another sector, Douglas, where I don't know about fishing. I think fishing is one of these things that's hard to decide who's involved and why they're involved. But the farming community can't be happy with chlorinated chicken being the next thing on the menu.
Well, no, I agree. And again, just going back to some recent experience in Westminster, with a meeting with the parliamentarians in the USA. And, you know, in terms of the trade deal for America, the UK and America, you know, food and drink just wasn't even on the menu, as it were, if I can use that. You know, they wanted to talk about, the UK wanted to talk about services. And I think, unfortunately, as these trade deals come apparent, I think, you know, the UK government will be doing a great disservice to our farmers and growers to add a bit more misery onto the fact that the you know, it's more difficult to now to trade into the EU, at least with the Brexit, the benefits have been members of that in terms of exporting abroad. But you know, I think as more individual trade deals are done, then I don't think the food and drink industry will be that well served by the UK government, and I think they'll tend to give away things on regulation around food and drink to make gains elsewhere, maybe in banking or finance. And you know, it could be that we end up with an awful lot of very, very unhappy farmers and growers across the country, because it still remains a big issue for Scotland. We're still growing off a lot of our own food, you know, long may that continue. And we grow it to a high standard as well. And so the level of husbandry and et cetera, is all very good in comparison with other countries.
I tend to watch in the evening later on, I tend to watch American news programs. Mm-hmm. And see what's going on with Mr. Trump, etc. But one of the things, there was an advert on and I couldn't understand it. Lady kept saying PGI, Scottish beef, Welsh beef PGI, and the red tractor. And I'm saying, what the hell is PGI? So I had to go and Google it, and it's progressive geographical indication. So you can tell where the whole beef has been all the way through its life. And I thought, if people have invested in that system, right? Yeah. If you think what it took to actually say, right, we'll do this and we'll tag the ears of the cattle, etc. And suddenly Boris says, right, okay, we're just going to let the Americans flood the market with chicken that's been chlorinated, stuffed in a can and exported. Yeah. That's a nightmare if you've spent your life building a farm and building the systems to try and produce quality food. And I just think all of these things are like dominoes, whether it's pensions, whether it's Brexit, whether it's effects, or whether it's COVID. And that's where, and I speak as a total yes activist, the sooner we get to the point where we're declaring independence, the better, because I can't think of a better time to be doing it.
Exactly, yeah. However, we need somebody to play a double six to start the dominoes game. So if you've got a double six in your hand, then for heaven's sake, get it on the table. It's time we got on with it.
Would this count as a double six? Assuming that Scotland voted at the next year's parliamentary elections, if there was a plurality majority of votes for the SNP, would you support a declaration of independence on that if you couldn't get a Section 30?
Well, I think there's a. I'm not sure if there's a better way than that. I think it's. I think you need to be able to win the support, not just here in Scotland, but you know, across the world. And I think we're watching the Catalonia situation, which I was quite closely involved with. You know, I think they are maybe ruined the day a wee bit that they declared their independence, but you know, found that they couldn't win that international support for their claim. I noticed today as well that I just received a, a document through from an organisation called Diplocat, which they work. I'm not quite sure how they're funded, but I think it's part through the universities and part through private enterprise and so on. But their aim is to make these links with other countries and try and sell the idea of Catalonia being an independent state, working with the EU and others to try and break down these barriers and add to the understanding of why Catalonia should be independent. And I think we could do well with having, prior to what you're suggesting, is having a Diplo Scot group that would actually do all that groundwork in the background beforehand. But I mean, ideally, you'd want people to vote for independence, and then the people on the other side of the Treaty of Union to actually accept the fact that that's how people had voted, and go into serious negotiations about how we divvy up the spoils between the two countries and go our own way. I think we still want to be really good friends, but we need to be in a position where, in the future, we need to make our own decisions on our economy and on the kind of society that we want to have, and who we want to be friends with across the rest of the world as well. So there's all these big questions that we need to ask ourselves. The UDI thing, I don't think is a goer from my point of view. I'd rather try and do it in a way that wins support both within the existing UK and wins support, and we go out our way to win support elsewhere across the world. And I'm not underestimating how difficult that would be in the current climate. But that would be my preferred route if it were possible to be delivered.
Sorry, Douglas. I don't want to break confidence in one aspect of what I'm going to say, but if you're aware, there is a move afoot to get people in the Yes movement to sign up for a digital covenant based on a blockchain.
Yep.
Now, that is public. What is not public is, I already know, and I won't say too much in this, that some of those involved in that have already established exactly the type of international contacts that would be needed for recognition. I have this, forgive me, I said I've never been a member of a political party, and I age you at the moment by quite a number of years, Douglas, so I'll say it this way. My involvement in the Yes movement came after the 2014 referendum. My single belief is that sovereignty is at the centre of this. We say, right, the people are sovereign. I don't think the people have yet truly exercised that sovereignty. It's a very, very unique quality to have. And it goes beyond, and in my opinion, it goes beyond political parties and political beliefs down to one simple thing, that a country whose people decide it should be independent so that they can choose their future. If they are sovereign, all they need to do is exercise that sovereignty. Now, how that is done is a matter of debate, but I don't think there's any debate over that it can be done, and that we need... I don't believe... I'll give you a simple example of this. Say Scotland, with our knowledge that we wish rid of Trident, if Scotland came out and said to the international community, we don't think things like that, what happened on the Chinese and Indian border the other day, which could have led to a nuclear bid, Scotland is going to sit down and say to the United Nations, we want rid of nuclear weapons from our country. We want to be independent to achieve that. Who in the international community, ignore the big powers, is going to disagree with that as a symbol of how an independent country can actually achieve something fairly on a world scale, getting rid of nuclear weapons from a country?
Well,
sorry, that was a speech.
Yeah, okay.
I'm prone to them, Douglas, if you don't know me.
No, you carry on. It's No, it's interesting to have this discussion, and I'm sure that there'll be a few things that will unfold over the next few months may change the world that we understand just now. It may change that drastically. So in terms of the Scottish independence debate, so let's wait and see what.
Do you see my fingers crossed?
Yes, absolutely.
Can I take Douglas into an area? You're involved, as I understand it, in defence procurement. That's your brief. Am I right or wrong?
It was up until December, but I know a wee bit about it. So if you want to fire away.
Yeah, it's an area I'm interested in. And how do I put this? Which is more likely, in your opinion, a nuclear attack in Scotland or a cyber attack on Scotland?
I don't think there's any doubt. I don't think there's, I think the risk of a nuclear attack is very, very slender. And in fact, I think an attack of any kind involving military forces, they're probably quite small. But the cyber attack is something that I think we need to be very wary of. I've been, again, doing some work quite recently with Estonia, and I was working with some of the guys from Phantom Power, and we've produced a little video of some interviews we did around Estonia being an e-nation. So, like, all the information you have, and the information is safeguarded, but the information that people can put forward, for example, means that your details about your housing application, your health service, your equivalent to your, maybe your road tax or whatever, your general tax, it's all held in the one place. So you're not constantly filling out all the same details on every single form when you apply for a grant, or when you you need to go to see the doctor or whatever. So there's so they've actually advanced that quite far. But one of the big areas that they're working on just now is obviously because the big threat is perceived to be Russia and the Baltics. So they've worked really hard with NATO to try and deal with any cyber attacks that they might have on their country. And again, Estonia, I think it's 1.3 million people, again, is a small European nation. And I think for small nations, I think we need to be really, much more wary of cyber attacks, whether that's attacks to our water system or to electricity, basic infrastructure, or whether it's to attack our banks or financial services, then it's something that we need to be very aware of. And it's the cyber industry, I think, is growing exponentially in terms of, protecting countries such as Scotland and institutions within countries.
The reason I asked the question, Douglas, I did a series of videos on this. Mm-hmm. And I did a post earlier on this morning on Facebook, which was on the basis that I don't think Scotland is adequately prepared for that. My brief being, as you know, being prepared for things. And the example I used was very simply as if Scotland came under a cyber attack. Not, see, the day one of independence, would we be prepared, or would we be phoning up our UK and saying, could GCHQ give us a hand with this? There's a lot of things that Scotland, it's not independence, it's the preparation that can be done before then. Yeah, I went onto your website this morning and had a quick look, and one of the Twitter links that you had was to the Cyber Academy at Napier. And that type of thing, I don't think we're thinking, or maybe it's me that's isolated, but I don't think there's enough public discussion of the threats that we may face, both during an election or a referendum or afterwards, to the infrastructure we have. yeah. came out this morning that Australia had said to China, we're not happy that we know what happened in Wuhan. All of the major parts of Australia are under cyber attack from China as we speak.
Yeah.
You know, and I just don't, maybe you know, that's why I asked you from the defence procurement point of view, do you know of any major studies that are going into protecting Scotland from cyber attack in the future as an independent country?
I would say as an independent country, I think, you know, all the links are through obviously the UK at the moment, because that's the political situation we're in. But I think you're absolutely right. I think much more needs to be done. And, you know, as far as our defence policy in the future is concerned, you know, I think both from a UK perspective and from a Scottish perspective, you know, I think cyber would be very much at the heart of protecting our own nation and making sure. I think the big word is resilience. You know, how do you make your country more resilient to unexpected things that might just come along? And it's having, if you don't know what the threats might be, then you can't plan what your response would be. So I think, you know, again, an awful lot of work needs to be done in that this whole field. And it's something, again, I'm really interested in pursuing. And we have a lot of talent in Scotland in this area, but I think it's how we pull all that together. I believe the Scottish Government do have a resilience unit that, you know, involves, like, Police Scotland and all the local authorities and all that kind of thing. But yeah, it comes back to what we're saying about Estonia. You know, you need all that integrated and joined up. And as we've seen through the COVID crisis, there's a lot of things that we trusted the UK to say, well, you'll be taking care of all that. And lo and behold, nobody was.
Couldn't agree with you more.
You know, too many people asleep at the wheel. And as a medium-sized country that is, you know, dependent on our things like banking and finance, our agriculture, our clean water, our fisheries and so on. I mean, all these could be under some sort of either electronic or biological attack in the future. And, you know, we need something in place to make sure that we have a real solid ability to respond to whatever might come our way. Because there are people out there who would want to do us harm in the early days of a young nation. So, you know, I think we need to be on the ball as far as that's concerned.
That was the irony I was alluding to, is that if you have to seek the support of GCHQ, you may actually be seeking the support of the very entity which is maybe causing you problems.
Yeah. Well, it could be that that's the case. I mean, again, there's no logical reason why England would want to undermine one of their closest neighbours, or, and, you know, economic. We'd still be an economic partner for the rest of the UK, and it would work both ways. So I don't know why you would want to undermine that market, but there again, stranger things have happened.
They did it with the EU. Well, I'm afraid that's almost done another hour anyway, so I think that's a bit time to wrap up. Thanks very much for coming on, Douglas. It's been illuminating. We'll maybe get you back.
I really enjoyed it. And hopefully you can maybe edit it down to about 3 minutes. And you might get a wee bit more than that, I don't know. But I'm sure you'll be able to pick out the best bits.
And, I don't know. I missed a bit about the American base. Yeah, that's going to keep them all thinking, what the hell is he talking about?
It's always a good excuse to invite me back at some point. So
yeah. Absolutely. Well, you're welcome back anytime.
But great to see you. Thanks very much for the...
Douglas, thank you very, very much.
No, appreciate it. Thank you. Bye, next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.